Chapter 86. I'm being held captive, the provost sensed as he paced the interior of the parked C-130 transport plane. He had agreed to go to Istanbul to help Sinsky avert this crisis before it went completely out of control. Not lost on the provost was the fact that cooperating with Sinsky might help mitigate any punitive backlash he might suffer for his inadvertent involvement in this crisis. But now Sinsky has me in custody. As soon as the plane had parked inside the government hangar at Ataturk Airport, Sinsky and her team had deplaned, and the head of the WHO ordered the provost and his few consortium staff members to stay aboard. The provost had attempted to step outside for a breath of air, but had been blocked by the stone-faced pilots, who reminded him that Dr. Sinsky had requested that everyone remain aboard. Not good, the provost thought, taking a seat as the uncertainty of his future truly began to settle in. The provost had long been accustomed to being the puppet master, the ultimate force that pulled the strings. And yet suddenly, all of his power had been snatched from him. Zobrist, Sienna, Sinsky, they had all defied him, manipulated him even. Now, trapped in the strange, windowless holding cell of the WHO's transport jet, he began to wonder if his luck had run out, if his current situation might be a kind of karmic retribution for a lifetime of dishonesty. I lie for a living. I am a purveyor of disinformation. While the provost was not the only one selling lies in this world, he had established himself as the biggest fish in the pond. The smaller fish were a different breed altogether, and the provost disliked even to be associated with them. Available online, businesses with names like the Alibi Company and Alibi Network made fortunes all over the world by providing unfaithful spouses with a way to cheat and not get caught, promising to briefly stop time so their clients could slip away from husband, wife, or kids. These organizations were masters at creating illusions, fake business conventions, fake doctor's appointments, even fake weddings, all of which included phony invitations, brochures, plane tickets, hotel confirmation forms, and even special contact numbers that rang at Alibi Company switchboards, where trained professionals pretended to be whatever receptionist or contact the illusion required. The provost, however, had never wasted his time with such petty artifice. He dealt solely with large-scale deception, plying his trade for those who could afford to pay millions of dollars in order to receive the best service. Governments, major corporations, the occasional ultra-wealthy VIP. To achieve their goals, these clients would have at their disposal all of the consortium's assets, personnel, experience, and creativity. Above all, though, they were given deniability, the assurance that whatever illusion was fabricated in support of their deception could never be traced to them. Whether trying to prop up a stock market, justify a war, win an election, or lure a terrorist out of hiding, the world's power brokers relied on massive disinformation schemes to help shape public perception. It had always been this way. In the 60s, the Russians built an entire fake spy network that dead-dropped bad intel that the British intercepted for years. In 1947, the U.S. Air Force manufactured an elaborate UFO hoax to divert attention from a classified plane crash in Roswell, New Mexico. And more recently, the world had been led to believe that weapons of mass destruction existed in Iraq. For nearly three decades, the provost had helped powerful people protect, retain, and increase their power. Although he was exceptionally careful about the jobs he accepted, the provost had always feared that one day he would take the wrong job. And now that day has arrived. Every epic collapse, the provost believed, could be traced back to a single moment. A chance meeting, a bad decision, an indiscreet glance. In this case, he realized, that instant had come almost a dozen years before, when he agreed to hire a young med school student who was looking for some extra money. The woman's keen intellect, dazzling language skills, and knack for improvisation made her an instantaneous standout at the consortium. Sienna Brooks was a natural. Sienna had immediately understood his operation, and the provost sensed that the young woman was no stranger to keeping secrets herself. Sienna worked for him for almost 2 years, earned a generous paycheck that helped her pay her med school tuition, and then, without warning, she announced that she was done. She wanted to save the world, and as she had told him, she couldn't do it there. The provost never imagined Sienna Brooks would resurface nearly a decade later, bringing with her a gift of sorts, an ultra-wealthy prospective client, Bertrand Zobrist. The provost bristled at the memory. This is Sienna's fault. She was a party to Zobrist's plan all along. Nearby, at the C-130's makeshift conference table, the conversation was becoming heated, with WHO officials talking on phones and arguing. Sienna Brooks? One demanded, shouting into the phone. Are you sure? The official listened a moment, frowning. Okay, get me the details. I'll hold. He covered the receiver and turned to his colleagues. It sounds like Sienna Brooks departed Italy shortly after we did. Everyone at the table stiffened. How? One female employee demanded. We covered the airport, bridges, train station? Nicelli Airfield, he replied, on the Lido. Not possible, the woman countered, shaking her head. Nicelli is tiny. There are no flights out. It handles only local helicopter tours and... Somehow Sienna Brooks had access to a private jet that was hangared at Nicelli. They're still looking into it. He raised the receiver to his mouth again. Yes, I'm here. What do you have? As he listened to the update, his shoulders slumped lower and lower until finally he took a seat. I understand. Thank you. He ended the call. His colleagues all stared at him expectantly. Sienna's jet was headed for Turkey, the man said, rubbing his eyes. Then call European Air Transport Command, someone declared. Have them turn the jet around. I can't, the man said. It landed 12 minutes ago at Hazarfen Private Airfield, only 15 miles from here. Sienna Brooks is gone. Chapter 87. Rain was now pelting the ancient dome of Hagia Sophia. For nearly 1,000 years, it had been the largest church in the world, and even now it was hard to imagine anything larger. Seeing it again, Langdon was reminded that the Emperor Justinian, upon the completion of Hagia Sophia, had stepped back and proudly proclaimed, Solomon, I have outdone thee. Sinsky and Bruder were marching with intensifying purpose toward the monumental building, which only seemed to swell in size as they approached. The walkways here were lined with the ancient cannonballs used by the forces of Mehmet the Conqueror, a decorative reminder that the history of this building had been filled with violence, as it was conquered and then retasked to serve the spiritual needs of assorted victorious powers. As they neared the southern facade, Langdon glanced to his right at the three domed silo-like appendages jutting off the building. These were the mausoleums of the sultans, one of whom, Murad III, was said to have fathered over 100 children. The ring of a cell phone cut the night air, and Bruder fished his out, checking the caller ID, and answered tersely, Anything? As he listened to the report, he shook his head in disbelief. How is that possible? He listened further and sighed. Okay, keep me posted. We're about to go inside. He hung up. What is it? Sinsky demanded. Keep your eyes open, Bruder said, glancing around the area. We may have company. He returned his gaze to Sinsky. It sounds like Sienna Brooks is in Istanbul. Langdon stared at the man, incredulous to hear both that Sienna had found a way to get to Turkey, and also that, having successfully escaped from Venice, she would risk capture and possible death to ensure that Bertrand Zobrist's plan succeeded. Sinsky looked equally alarmed and drew a breath as if preparing to interrogate Bruder further, but she apparently thought better of it, turning instead to Langdon.
Which way?
Langdon pointed to their left, around the southwest corner of the building. The Fountain of Ablutions is over here, he said. Their rendezvous point with the museum contact was an ornately latticed wellhead that had once been used for ritual washing before Muslim prayer.
Professor Langdon!
A man's voice shouted as they drew near. A smiling Turkish man stepped out from under the octagonal cupola that covered the fountain. He was waving his arms excitedly.
Professor, over here.
Langdon and the others hurried over.
Hello.
My name is Mirsat, he said,
his accented English voice brimming with enthusiasm. He was a slight man with thinning hair, scholarly-looking glasses, and a gray suit.
This is a great honor for me.
The honor is ours, Langdon replied, shaking Mirsat's hand. Thank you for your hospitality on such short notice.
Yes, yes. I'm Elizabeth Sinsky,
Dr. Sinsky said, shaking Mirsat's hand and then motioning to Bruder.
And this is Christoph Bruder. We're here to assist, Professor Langdon. I'm so sorry our plane was delayed. You're very kind to accommodate us.
Please think nothing of it, Mirsat gushed.
For Professor Langdon, I would give a private tour at any hour. His little book, Christian Symbols in the Muslim World, is a favorite in our museum gift shop.
Really? Langdon thought. Now I know the one place on Earth that carries that book.
Shall we?
Mirsat said, motioning for them to follow. The group hurried across a small open space, passing the regular tourist entrance and continuing on to what had originally been the building's main entrance, three deeply recessed archways with massive bronze doors. Two armed security guards were waiting to greet them. Upon seeing Mirsat, the guards unlocked one of the doors and swung it open.
Sağ olun, Mirsat said,
uttering one of a handful of Turkish phrases Langdon was familiar with, an especially polite form of thank you. The group stepped through, and the guards closed the heavy doors behind them, the thud resonating through the stone interior. Langdon and the others were now standing in Hagia Sophia's narthex, a narrow antechamber that was common in Christian churches and served as an architectural buffer between the divine and the profane. Spiritual moats, Langdon often called them. The group crossed toward another set of doors, and Mirsat pulled one open. Beyond it, instead of the sanctuary he had anticipated seeing, Langdon beheld a secondary narthex, slightly larger than the first. An Esso narthex, Langdon realized, having forgotten that Hagia Sophia's sanctuary enjoyed two levels of protection from the outside world. As if to prepare the visitor for what lay ahead, the Esso narthex was significantly more ornate than the narthex, its walls made of burnished stone that glowed in the light of elegant chandeliers. On the far side of the serene space stood four doors, above which were spectacular mosaics, which Langdon found himself intently admiring. Mirsat walked to the largest door, a colossal bronze-plated portal.
"The imperial doorway,"
Mirsat whispered, his voice almost giddy with enthusiasm.
"In Byzantine times, this door was reserved for sole use of the emperor. Tourists don't usually go through it, but this is a special night."
Mirsat reached for the door, but paused.
"Before we enter," he whispered, "let me ask, is there something in particular you would like to see inside?"
Langdon, Sinsky, and Bruder all glanced at one another. "Yes," Langdon said. "There's so much to see, of course, but if we could, we'd like to begin with the tomb of Enrico Dandolo." Mirsat cocked his head as if he had misunderstood.
"I'm sorry? You want to see Dandolo's tomb?"
"We do." Mirsat looked downcast.
"But, sir, Dandolo's tomb is very plain. No symbols at all. Not our finest offering."
"I realize that," Langdon said politely. "All the same, we'd be most grateful if you could take us to it." Mirsat studied Langdon a long moment, and then his eyes drifted upward to the mosaic directly over the door, which Langdon had just been admiring. The mosaic was a 9th-century image of the Pantocrator Christ, the iconic image of Christ holding the New Testament in his left hand while making a blessing with his right. Then, as if a light had suddenly dawned for their guide, the corners of Mirsat's lips curled into a knowing smile, and he began wagging his finger.
"Clever man, very clever."
Langdon stared. "I'm sorry?"
"Don't worry, Professor," Mirsat said in a conspiratorial whisper. "I won't tell anyone why you're really here."
Sinsky and Bruder shot Langdon a puzzled look. All Langdon could do was shrug as Mirsat heaved open the door and ushered them inside. Chapter 88. The Eighth Wonder of the World, some had called this space, And standing in it now, Langdon was not about to argue with that assessment. As the group stepped across the threshold into the colossal sanctuary, Langdon was reminded that Hagia Sophia required only an instant to impress upon its visitors the sheer magnitude of its proportions. So vast was this room that it seemed to dwarf even the great cathedrals of Europe. The staggering force of its enormity was, Langdon knew, partly an illusion, a dramatic side effect of its Byzantine floor plan. With a centralized naos that concentrated all of its interior space in a single square room, rather than extending it along the four arms of a cruciform, as was the style adopted in later cathedrals.
This building is 700 years older than Notre Dame, Langdon thought.
After taking a moment to absorb the breadth of the room's dimensions, Langdon let his eyes climb skyward more than 150 feet overhead to the sprawling golden dome that crowned the room. From its central point, 40 ribs radiated outward like rays of the sun, extending to a circular arcade of 40 arched windows. During daylight hours, the light that streamed through these windows reflected and re-reflected off glass shards embedded in the golden tilework, creating the mystical light for which Hagia Sophia was most famous. Langdon had seen the gilded ambience of this room captured accurately in painting only once. John Singer Sargent. Not surprisingly, in creating his famous painting of Hagia Sophia, the American artist had limited his palette only to multiple shades of a single color. Gold. The glistening golden cupola was often called the Dome of Heaven itself, and was supported by four tremendous arches, which in turn were sustained by a series of semi-domes and tympana. These supports were then carried by yet another descending tier of smaller semi-domes and arcades, creating the effect of a cascade of architectural forms working their way from heaven toward earth. Moving from heaven to earth, albeit by a more direct route, long cables descended straight down from the dome and supported a sea of gleaming chandeliers, which seemed to hang so low to the floor that tall visitors risked colliding with them. In reality, this was another illusion created by the sheer magnitude of the space, for the fixtures hung more than 12 feet off the floor. As with all great shrines, Hagia Sophia's prodigious size served two purposes. First, it was proof to God of the great lengths to which man would go to pay tribute to him. And second, it served as a kind of shock treatment for worshippers, a physical space so imposing that those who entered felt dwarfed, their egos erased, their physical being and cosmic importance shrinking to the size of a mere speck in the face of God, an atom in the hands of the Creator. Until a man is nothing, God can make nothing out of him. Martin Luther had spoken those words in the 16th century, but the concept had been part of the mindset of builders since the earliest examples of religious architecture. Langdon glanced over at Bruder and Sinsky, who had been staring upward, and who now lowered their eyes to earth.
Jesus, Bruder said.
Yes, Mirsat said excitedly, and Allah and Muhammad too.
Langdon chuckled as their guide directed Bruder's gaze to the main altar, where a towering mosaic of Jesus was flanked by two massive discs bearing the Arabic names of Muhammad and Allah in ornate calligraphy.
This museum, Mirsat explained, in an effort to remind visitors of the diverse uses of this sacred space, displays in tandem both the Christian iconography from the days when Hagia Sophia was a basilica and the Islamic iconography from its days as a mosque. He gave a proud smile. Despite the friction between the religions in the real world, we think their symbols work quite nicely together. I know you agree, Professor.
Langdon gave a heartfelt nod, recalling that all of the Christian iconography had been covered in whitewash when the building became a mosque. The restoration of the Christian symbols next to the Muslim symbols had created a mesmerizing effect, particularly because the styles and sensibilities of the two iconographies are polar opposites. While Christian tradition favored literal images of its gods and saints, Islam focused on calligraphy and geometric patterns to represent the beauty of God's universe. Islamic tradition held that only God could create life, and therefore man has no place creating images of life, not gods, not people, not even animals. Langdon recalled once trying to explain this concept to his students. A Muslim Michelangelo, for example, would never have painted God's face on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. He would have inscribed the name of God. Depicting God's face would be considered blasphemy. Langdon had gone on to explain the reason for this. Both Christianity and Islam are logocentric, he told his students, meaning they are focused on the Word. In Christian tradition, the Word became flesh in the book of John. And the Word was made flesh, and he dwelt among us. Therefore, it was acceptable to depict the Word as having a human form. In Islamic tradition, however, the Word did not become flesh, and therefore the Word needs to remain in the form of a word. In most cases, calligraphic renderings of the names of the holy figures of Islam. One of Langdon's students had summed up the complex history with an amusingly accurate marginal note. Christians like faces, Muslims like words.
Here before us, Mirsat went on, motioning across the spectacular room, you see a unique blending of Christianity with Islam.
He quickly pointed out the fusion of symbols in the massive apse, most notably the Virgin and Child gazing down upon a mihrab, the semicircular niche in a mosque that indicates the direction of Mecca. Nearby, a staircase rose up to an orator's pulpit, which resembled the kind from which Christian sermons are delivered, but in fact was a minbar, the holy platform from which an imam leads Friday services. Similarly, the dais-like structure nearby resembled a Christian choir stall, but in reality was a muezzin mafili, a raised platform where a muezzin kneels and chants in response to the imam's prayers.
Mosques and cathedrals are startlingly similar, Mirsat proclaimed. The traditions of East and West are not as divergent as you might think.
Mirsat, Bruder pressed, sounding impatient, we'd really like to see Dandolo's tomb, if we may.
Mirsat looked mildly annoyed, as if the man's haste were somehow a display of disrespect to the building. Yes, Langdon said, I'm sorry to rush, but we're on a very tight schedule.
Very well, then,
Mirsat said, pointing to a high balcony to their right.
Let's head upstairs and see the tomb.
Up, Langdon replied, startled. Isn't Enrico Dandolo buried down in the crypt? Langdon recalled the tomb itself, but not the precise place in the building where it was located. He had been picturing the dark underground areas of the building. Mirsat seemed confounded by the query.
No, Professor. The tomb of Enrico Dandolo is most certainly upstairs.
What the devil is going on here? Mirsat wondered. When Langdon had asked to see Dandolo's tomb, Mirsat had sensed that the request was a kind of decoy.
Nobody wants to see Dandolo's tomb.
Mirsat had assumed what Langdon really wanted to see was the enigmatic treasure directly beside Dandolo's tomb. The Deesis mosaic, an ancient pantocrator Christ that was arguably one of the most mysterious pieces of art in the building.
Langdon is researching the mosaic and trying to be discreet about it, Mirsat had guessed,
imagining that the professor was probably writing a secret piece on the Deesis. Now, however, Mirsat was confused. Certainly Langdon knew the Deesis mosaic was on the second floor, so why was he acting so surprised?
Unless he is indeed looking for Dandolo's tomb.
Puzzled, Mirsat guided them toward the staircase, passing one of Hagia Sophia's two famous urns, a 330-gallon behemoth carved out of a single piece of marble during the Hellenistic period. Climbing in silence now with his entourage, Mirsat found himself feeling unsettled. Langdon's colleagues did not seem like academics at all. One of them looked like a soldier of some sort, muscular and rigid, dressed all in black. And the woman with the silver hair. Mirsat sensed he had seen her before. Maybe on television? He was starting to suspect that the purpose of this visit was not what it appeared to be.
Why are they really here?
One more flight, Mirsat announced cheerily as they reached the landing.
Upstairs, we shall find the tomb of Enrico Dandolo, and of course,
he paused, eyeing Langdon,
the famed Deesis mosaic.
Not even a flinch. Langdon, it appeared, was not, in fact, here for the Deesis mosaic at all. He and his guests seemed inexplicably fixated on Dandolo's tomb. Chapter 89. As Mirsat led the way up the stairs, Langdon could tell that Bruder and Sinsky were worried. Admittedly, ascending to the second floor seemed to make no sense. Langdon kept picturing Zobrist's subterranean video and the documentary film about the submerged areas beneath Hagia Sophia.
We need to go down.
Even so, if this was the location of Dandolo's tomb, they had no choice but to follow Zobrist's directions. Kneel within the gilded mosaic of holy wisdom, and place thine ear to the ground, listening for the sounds of trickling water. When they finally reached the second level, Mirsat led them to the right, along the balcony's edge, which offered breathtaking views of the sanctuary below. Langdon faced front, remaining focused. Mirsat was talking fervently about the Deesis mosaic again, but Langdon tuned him out. He could now see his target, Dandolo's tomb. The tomb appeared exactly as Langdon remembered it, a rectangular piece of white marble inlaid in the polished stone floor and cordoned off by stanchions and chains. Langdon rushed over and examined the carved inscription. Henricus Dandolo. As the others arrived behind him, Langdon sprang into action, stepping over the protective chain and placing his feet directly in front of the tombstone. Mirsat protested loudly, but Langdon continued, dropping quickly to his knees, as if preparing to pray at the feet of the treacherous Doge. Next, in a move that elicited shouts of horror from Mirsat, Langdon placed his palms flat on the tomb and prostrated himself. As he lowered his face to the ground, Langdon realized that he looked like he was bowing to Mecca. The maneuver apparently stunned Mirsat, who fell mute, and a sudden hush seemed to pervade the entire building. Taking a deep breath, Langdon turned his head to the right and gently pressed his left ear to the tomb. The stone felt cold on his flesh. The sound he heard echoing up through the stone was as clear as day. My God! The finale of Dante's Inferno seemed to be echoing up from below. Slowly, Langdon turned his head, gazing up at Bruder and Sinsky. I hear it, he whispered. The sounds of trickling water. Bruder vaulted the chain and crouched down beside Langdon to listen. After a moment, he was nodding intently. Now that they could hear the water flowing downward, one question remained. Where is it flowing? Langdon's mind was suddenly flooded with images of a half-submerged cavern, bathed in an eerie red light, somewhere beneath them. Follow deep into the sunken palace, for here in the darkness the thonic monster waits, submerged in the blood-red waters of the lagoon that reflects no stars. When Langdon stood and stepped back over the stanchions, Mirsat was glaring up at him with a look of alarm and betrayal on his face. Langdon stood almost a foot taller than the Turkish guide. Mirsat, Langdon began, I'm sorry. As you can see, this is a very unusual situation. I don't have time to explain, but I have a very important question to ask you about this building. Mirsat managed a weak nod.
Okay.
Here at Dandolo's tomb, we can hear a rivulet of water flowing somewhere under the stone. We need to know where this water flows. Mirsat shook his head.
I don't understand. Water can be heard beneath the floors everywhere in Hagia Sophia.
Everyone stiffened.
Yes, Mirsat told them, especially when it rains. Hagia Sophia has approximately 100,000 square feet of rooftops that need to drain, and it often takes days. And usually it rains again before the drainage is complete. The sounds of trickling water are quite common here. Perhaps you are aware that Hagia Sophia sits on vast caverns of water. There was a documentary, even, which...
Yes, yes, Langdon said, but do you know if the water that is audible here at Dandolo's tomb flows somewhere specific?
Of course, Mirsat said. It flows to the same place that all the water shedding from Hagia Sophia flows. To the city cistern.
No, Bruder declared, stepping back over the stanchion. We're not looking for a cistern. We're looking for a large underground space, perhaps with columns?
Yes, Mirsat said.
The city's ancient cistern is precisely that. A large underground space with columns. Quite impressive, actually. It was built in the 6th century to house the city's water supply. Nowadays it contains only about 4 feet of water, but...
Where is it?
Bruder demanded, his voice echoing across the empty hall.
The cistern?
Mirsat asked, looking frightened.
It's a block away, just east of this building.
He pointed outside.
It's called Yerbatan Sarayi.
Sarayi? Langdon wondered. As in Topkapi Sarayi? Signage for the Topkapi Palace had been ubiquitous as they were driving in. But doesn't Sarayi mean palace? Mirsat nodded.
Yes. The name of our ancient cistern is Yerbatan Sarayi. It means the sunken palace.
Chapter 90. The rain was falling in sheets as Dr. Elizabeth Sinsky burst out of Hagia Sophia with Langdon, Bruder, and their bewildered guide, Mirsat.
Followed deep into the sunken palace, Sinsky thought.
The site of the city's cistern, Yerbatan Sarayi, was apparently back toward the Blue Mosque and a bit to the north. Mirsat led the way. Sinsky had seen no other option but to tell Mirsat who they were and that they were racing to thwart a possible health crisis within the sunken palace.
This way,
Mirsat called, leading them across the darkened park. The mountain of Hagia Sophia was behind them now, and the fairy tale spires of the Blue Mosque glistened ahead. Hurrying beside Sinsky, Agent Bruder was shouting into his phone, updating the SRS team and ordering them to rendezvous at the cistern's entrance.
It sounds like Zobrist is targeting the city's water supply, Bruder said, breathless. I'm going to need schematics of all conduits in and out of the cistern. We'll run full isolation and containment protocols. We'll need physical and chemical barriers along with vacuum.
Wait,
Mirsat called over to him.
You misunderstood me. The cistern is not the city water supply. Not anymore.
Bruder lowered his phone, glaring at their guide.
What?
In ancient times, the cistern held the water supply,
Mirsat clarified.
But no longer. We modernized.
Bruder came to a stop under a sheltering tree, and everyone halted with him.
Mirsat, Sinsky said, you're sure that nobody drinks the water out of the cistern?
Heavens no,
Mirsat said. The water pretty much just sits there, eventually filtering down into the earth. Sinsky, Langdon, and Bruder all exchanged uncertain looks. Sinsky didn't know whether to feel relieved or alarmed.
If nobody comes in regular contact with the water, why would Zobrist choose to contaminate it?
When we modernized our water supply decades ago,
Mirsat explained,
the cistern fell out of use and became just a big pond in an underground room.
He shrugged.
These days it's nothing more than a tourist attraction.
Sinsky spun toward Mirsat.
A tourist attraction?
Hold on. People can go down there? Into the cistern? Of course, he said. Many thousands visit every day. The cavern is quite striking. There are boardwalks over the water and even a small cafe. There's limited ventilation, so the air is quite stuffy and humid, but it's still very popular.
Sinsky's eyes locked on Bruder, and she could tell that she and the trained SRS agent were picturing the same thing. A dark, humid cavern filled with stagnant water in which a pathogen was incubating. Completing the nightmare was the presence of boardwalks over which tourists moved all day long, just above the water's surface.
He's created a bioaerosol, Bruder declared.
Sinsky nodded, slumping.
Meaning?
Langdon demanded.
Meaning, Bruder replied, that it can go airborne.
Langdon fell silent, and Sinsky could see that he was now grasping the potential magnitude of this crisis. An airborne pathogen had been on Sinsky's mind as a possible scenario for some time, and yet when she believed that the cistern was the city's water supply, she had hoped maybe this meant that Zobrist had chosen a water-bound bioform. Water-dwelling bacteria were robust and weather-resistant, but they were also slow to propagate. Airborne pathogens spread fast, very fast.
If it's airborne, Bruder said, it's probably viral.
A virus, Sinsky agreed. The fastest-spreading pathogen Zobrist could choose.
Releasing an airborne virus underwater was admittedly unusual, And yet there were many life forms that incubated in liquid and then hatched into the air. Mosquitoes, mold spores, the bacterium that caused Legionnaire's disease, mycotoxins, red tide, even human beings. Sinsky grimly pictured the virus permeating the cistern's lagoon, and then the infected microdroplets rising into the damp air. Mirsat was now staring across a traffic-jammed street with a look of apprehension on his face. Sinsky followed his gaze to a squat, red-and-white brick building whose single door was open, revealing what looked to be a stairwell. A scattering of well-dressed people seemed to be waiting outside under umbrellas, while a doorman controlled the flow of guests who were descending the stairs. Some kind of underground dance club? Sinsky saw the gold lettering on the building and felt a sudden tightness in her chest. Unless this club was called the Cistern and had been built in AD 523, she realized why Mirsat was looking so concerned.
"The Sunken Palace," Mirsat stammered. "It seems there is a concert tonight."
Sinsky was incredulous.
"A concert in a cistern?"
"It's a large indoor space," he replied. "It's often used as a cultural center." Bruder had apparently heard enough. He dashed toward the building, sidestepping his way through snarled traffic on Alemdar Avenue. Sinsky and the others broke into a run as well, close on the agent's heels. When they arrived at the cistern entrance, the doorway was blocked by a handful of concertgoers who were waiting to be let in, a trio of women in burkas, a pair of tourists holding hands, a man in a tuxedo. They were all clustered together in the doorway, trying to keep out of the rain. Sinsky could hear the melodic strains of a classical music composition lilting up from below. Berlioz, she guessed, from the idiosyncratic orchestration. But whatever it was, it felt out of place here in the streets of Istanbul. As they drew closer to the doorway, she felt a warm wind rushing up the stairs, billowing from deep inside the earth and escaping from the enclosed cavern. The wind brought to the surface not only the sound of violins, but the unmistakable sense of humidity and masses of people. It also brought to Sinsky a deep sense of foreboding. As a group of tourists emerged from the stairs, chatting happily as they exited the building, the doorman allowed the next group to descend. Bruder immediately moved to enter, but the doorman stopped him with a pleasant wave.
"One moment, sir. The cistern is at capacity. It should be less than a minute until another visitor exits. Thank you."
Bruder looked ready to force his way in, but Sinsky placed a hand on his shoulder and pulled him off to one side.
"Wait," she commanded. "Your team is on the way, and you can't search this place alone."
She motioned to the plaque on the wall beside the door.
"The cistern is enormous."
The informational plaque described a cathedral-sized subterranean room, nearly 2 football fields in length, with a ceiling spanning more than 100,000 square feet and supported by a forest of 336 marble columns. "Look at this," Langdon said, standing a few yards away. "You're not going to believe it." Sinsky turned. Langdon motioned to a concert poster on the wall.
"Oh, dear God."
The WHO director had been correct in identifying the style of the music as romantic, but the piece that was being performed had not been composed by Berlioz. It was by a different romantic composer, Franz Liszt. Tonight, deep within the earth, the Istanbul State Symphony Orchestra was performing one of Franz Liszt's most famous works, the Dante Symphony, an entire composition inspired by Dante's descent into and return from hell. "It's being performed here for a week," Langdon said, scrutinizing the poster's fine print. "A free concert, underwritten by an anonymous donor." Sinsky suspected that she could guess the identity of the anonymous donor. Bertrand Zobrist's flair for the dramatic, it seemed, was also a ruthless practical strategy. This week of free concerts would lure thousands more tourists than usual down into the cistern and place them in a congested area, where they would breathe the contaminated air, then travel back to their homes both here and abroad.
"Sir," the doorman called to Bruder, "we have room for a couple more."
Bruder turned to Sinsky.
"Call the local authorities. Whatever we find down there, we'll need support. When my team arrives, have them radio me for an update. I'll go down and see if I can get a sense of where Zobrist might have tethered this thing."
"Without a respirator?"
Sinsky asked.
You don't know for a fact the Solyablan bag is intact.
Bruder frowned, holding his hand up in the warm wind that was blowing out of the doorway.
I hate to say this, but if this contagion is out, I'm guessing everyone in this city is probably infected.
Sinsky had been thinking the same thing, but hadn't wanted to say it in front of Langdon and Mirsat.
Besides, Bruder added, I've seen what happens to crowds when my team marches in wearing hazmat suits. We'd have full-scale panic and a stampede.
Sinsky decided to defer to Bruder. He was, after all, the specialist, and had been in situations like this before.
Our only realistic option, Bruder told her, is to assume it's still safe down there and make a play to contain this.
Okay, Sinsky said. Do it.
There's another problem, Langdon interjected. What about Sienna? What about her? Bruder demanded. Whatever her intentions may be here in Istanbul, she's very good with languages and possibly speaks some Turkish.
So?
Sienna knows the poem references the sunken palace, Langdon said, and in Turkish, sunken palace literally points, he motioned to the Yerbatan Sarayi sign over the doorway. Here.
That's true, Sinsky wearily agreed. She may have figured this out and bypassed Hagia Sophia altogether.
Bruder glanced at the lone doorway and cursed under his breath.
Okay, if she's down there and plans to break the Solyablan bag before we can contain it, at least she hasn't been there long. It's a huge area, and she probably has no idea where to look. And with all those people around, she probably can't just dive into the water unnoticed.
Sir, the doorman called again to Bruder, would you like to enter now?
Bruder could see another group of concertgoers approaching from across the street, and nodded to the doorman that he was indeed coming.
I'm coming with you, Langdon said, following.
Bruder turned and faced him.
No chance.
Langdon's tone was unyielding. Agent Bruder, one of the reasons we're in this situation is that Sienna Brooks has been playing me all day. And as you said, we may all be infected already. I'm helping you whether you like it or not. Bruder stared at him a moment, and then relented. As Langdon passed through the doorway and began descending the steep staircase behind Bruder, he could feel the warm wind rushing past them from the bowels of the cistern. The humid breeze carried on it the strains of Liszt's Dante Symphony, as well as a familiar yet ineffable scent, that of a massive crush of people congregated together in an enclosed space. Langdon suddenly felt a ghostly pall envelop him, as if the long fingers of an unseen hand were reaching out of the earth and raking his flesh. The music, the symphony chorus, 100 voices strong, was now singing a well-known passage articulating every syllable of Dante's gloomy text.
Lasciate ogni speranza, they were now chanting, voi che entrate.
These 6 words, the most famous line in all of Dante's Inferno, welled up from the bottom of the stairs like the ominous stench of death. Accompanied by a swell of trumpets and horns, the choir intoned the warning again.
Lasciate ogni speranza voi che entrate.
Abandon all hope, ye who enter here. Chapter 91. Bathed in red light, the subterranean cavern resonated with the sounds of hell-inspired music, the wail of voices, the dissonant pinch of strings, and the deep roll of timpani, which thundered through the grotto like a seismic tremor. As far as Langdon could see, the floor of this underground world was a glassy sheet of water, dark, still, smooth, like black ice on a frozen New England pond. The lagoon that reflects no stars. Rising out of the water, meticulously arranged in seemingly endless rows, were hundreds upon hundreds of thick Doric columns, each climbing 30 feet to support the cavern's vaulted ceiling. The columns were lit from below by a series of individual red spotlights, creating a surreal forest of illuminated trunks that telescoped off into the darkness like some kind of mirrored illusion. Langdon and Bruder paused at the bottom of the stairs, momentarily stalled on the threshold of the spectral hollow before them. The cavern itself seemed to glow with a reddish hue, and as Langdon took it all in, he could feel himself breathing as shallowly as possible. The air down here was heavier than he'd imagined. Langdon could see the crowd in the distance to their left, The concert was taking place deep in the underground space, halfway back against the far wall, its audience seated on an expanse of platforms. Several hundred spectators sat in concentric rings that had been arranged around the orchestra, while 100 more stood around the perimeter. Still others had taken up positions out on the near boardwalks, leaning on the sturdy railings and gazing down into the water as they listened to the music. Langdon found himself scanning the sea of amorphous silhouettes, his eyes searching for Sienna. She was nowhere in sight. Instead, he saw figures in tuxedos, gowns, bishts, burkas, and even tourists in shorts and sweatshirts. The cross-section of humanity gathered in the crimson light looked to Langdon like celebrants in some kind of occult mass. If Sienna's down here, he realized, it will be nearly impossible to spot her. At that moment, a heavy-set man moved past them, exiting up the stairs, coughing as he went. Bruder spun and watched him go, scrutinizing him carefully. Langdon felt a faint tickle in his own throat, but told himself it was his imagination. Bruder now took a tentative step forward on the boardwalk, eyeing their numerous options. The path before them looked like the entrance to the Minotaur's labyrinth. The single boardwalk quickly forked into three, each of those branching off again, creating a suspended maze hovering over the water, weaving in and out of the columns and snaking into the darkness. I found myself within a forest dark, Langdon thought, recalling the ominous first canto of Dante's masterwork, for the straightforward pathway had been lost. Langdon peered over the walkway's railing into the water. It was about 4 feet deep and surprisingly clear. The stone tile floor was visible, blanketed by a fine layer of silt. Bruder took a quick look down, gave a non-committal grunt, and then raised his eyes back to the room.
Do you see anything that looks like the area in Zobrist's video?
Everything, Langdon thought, surveying the steep, damp walls around them. He motioned to the most remote corner of the cavern, far off to the right, away from the congestion of the orchestral platform.
I'm guessing back there somewhere.
Bruder nodded.
My instinct as well.
The two of them hurried down the boardwalk, choosing the right-hand fork, which carried them away from the crowd in the direction of the farthest reaches of the sunken palace. As they walked, Langdon realized how easy it would be to hide overnight in this space, undetected. Zobrist could have done just that to make his video. Of course, if he had generously underwritten this week-long concert series, he also could have simply requested some private time in the cistern. Not that it matters any more. Bruder was striding faster now, as if subconsciously keeping pace with the symphony's tempo, which had increased into a cascading series of descending semitone suspensions. Dante and Virgil's descent into hell. Langdon intently scanned the steep, mossy walls in the distance to their right, trying to match them up with what they had seen in the video. At each new fork in the boardwalk, they turned right, moving farther from the crowd, heading for the cavern's most remote corner. Langdon looked back and was astounded by the distance they had covered. They advanced at almost a jog now, passing a handful of meandering visitors. But by the time they entered the deepest parts of the cistern, the number of people had thinned to nothing. Bruder and Langdon were alone.
It all looks the same, Bruder despaired. Where do we start?
Langdon shared his frustration. He remembered the video vividly, but nothing down here leaped out as a recognizable feature. Langdon studied the softly lit informational signs that dotted the boardwalk as they moved ahead. One described the 21-million-gallon capacity of the room. Another pointed out a non-matching pillar that had been looted from a nearby structure during construction. And still another offered a diagram of an ancient carving now faded from view. The crying hen's eye symbol, which wept for all the slaves who died while building the cistern. Strangely, it was a sign that bore a single word that now stopped Langdon dead in his tracks. Bruder halted too, turning.
What's wrong?
Langdon pointed. On the sign, accompanied by a directional arrow, was the name of a fearsome gorgon. An infamous female monster. Medusa. Bruder read the sign and shrugged.
So what?
Langdon's heart was pounding. He knew Medusa was not only the fearsome snake-haired spirit whose gaze could turn anyone who looked at her to stone, but was also a prominent member of the Greek pantheon of subterranean spirits, a specific category known as the Thonic Monsters. Follow deep into the sunken palace, for here, in the darkness, the Thonic Monster waits. She's pointing the way, Langdon realized, breaking into a run along the boardwalk. Bruder could barely keep up with him as Langdon zigzagged into the darkness, following the signs for Medusa. Finally, he reached a dead end at a small viewing platform near the base of the cistern's rightmost wall. There before him was an incredible sight. Rising out of the water was a colossal carved marble block, the head of Medusa, her hair writhing with snakes. Making her presence here even more bizarre was the fact that her head had been placed on her neck upside down. Inverted as the damned, Langdon realized, picturing Botticelli's map of hell and the inverted sinners he had placed in the Malabolge. Bruder arrived breathless beside Langdon at the railing, staring out at the upside-down Medusa with a look of bewilderment. Langdon suspected that this carved head, which now served as a plinth supporting one of the columns, had probably been pillaged from elsewhere and used here as an inexpensive building supply. The reason for Medusa's inverted position was, no doubt, the superstitious belief that the inversion would rob her of her evil powers. Even so, Langdon could not shake off the barrage of haunting thoughts that assailed him. Dante's Inferno, the finale, the center of the earth, where gravity inverts itself, where up becomes down. His skin now prickling with foreboding, Langdon squinted through the reddish haze that surrounded the sculpted head. Most of Medusa's serpent-infested hair was submerged underwater, but her eyes were above the surface, facing to the left, staring out across the lagoon. Fearfully, Langdon leaned over the railing and turned his head, letting his gaze follow the statues out into the familiar empty corner of the sunken palace. In an instant, he knew. This was the spot. Zobrist's Ground Zero. Chapter 92. Agent Bruder lowered himself stealthily, sliding beneath the railing and dropping down into the chest-deep water. As the rush of cool liquid permeated his clothing, his muscles tensed against the chill. The floor of the cistern was slippery beneath his boots, but it felt solid. He stood a moment, taking stock, watching the concentric circles of water rippling away from his body like shock waves across the lagoon. For a moment, Bruder didn't breathe.
"Move slowly," he told himself. "Create no turbulence."
Above him on the boardwalk, Langdon stood at the railing, scanning the surrounding boardwalks.
"All set," Langdon whispered. "Nobody sees you."
Bruder turned and faced the huge upside-down head of Medusa, which was brightly lit by a red spotlight. The inverted monster looked even larger now that Bruder was down at her level.
"Follow Medusa's gaze across the lagoon," Langdon whispered. "Zobrist had a flair for symbolism and dramatics. I wouldn't be surprised if he placed his creation directly in the lethal sightline of Medusa."
"Great minds think alike."
Bruder felt grateful that the American professor had insisted on making the descent with him. Langdon's expertise had guided them almost immediately to this distant corner of the cistern. As the strains of the Dante Symphony continued to reverberate in the distance, Bruder took out his waterproof Tovatec penlight and submerged it beneath the water, flipping the switch. A bright, halogen beam pierced the water, illuminating the cistern floor before him.
"Easy," Bruder reminded himself. "Don't disturb a thing."
Without another word, he began his careful journey out into the lagoon, wading in slow motion through the water, moving his flashlight methodically back and forth, like an underwater minesweeper. At the railing, Langdon had begun to feel an unsettling tightness in his throat. The air in the cistern, despite the humidity, tasted stale and oxygen-depleted to him. As Bruder waded carefully out into the lagoon, the professor reassured himself that everything would be fine.
"We arrived in time. It's all intact.
Bruder's team can contain this." Even so, Langdon felt jumpy. As a lifelong claustrophobe, he knew he would be anxious down here under any circumstances.
Something about thousands of tons of earth hovering overhead, supported by nothing but decaying pillars.
He pushed the thought from his mind and took another glance behind him for anyone taking undue interest. Nothing.
The only people nearby were standing on various other boardwalks, and they were all looking in the opposite direction, toward the orchestra. No one seemed to have noticed Bruder slowly wading across the water in this deep corner of the cistern. Langdon returned his gaze to the SRS team leader, whose submerged halogen beam still oscillated eerily in front of him, lighting the way. As Langdon looked on, his peripheral vision suddenly picked up a movement to his left, an ominous black form rising out of the water in front of Bruder. Langdon wheeled and stared into the looming darkness, half expecting to see some kind of leviathan rearing up from beneath the surface. Bruder had stopped short, apparently having seen it too. In the far corner, a wavering black shape rose some 30 feet up the wall. The ghostly silhouette looked nearly identical to that of the plague doctor who'd appeared in Zobrist's video.
It's a shadow, Langdon realized, exhaling. Bruder's shadow.
The shadow had been cast as Bruder moved past a submerged spotlight in the lagoon, exactly, it seemed, as Zobrist's shadow had done in the video.
This is the spot, Langdon called out to Bruder. You're close.
Bruder nodded and continued inching his way out into the lagoon. Langdon moved along the railing, staying even with him. As the agent moved farther and farther away, Langdon stole another quick glance toward the orchestra to make sure Bruder had not been noticed. Nothing. As Langdon again returned his gaze to the lagoon, a glint of reflected light caught his eye on the boardwalk at his feet. He looked down and saw a tiny puddle of red liquid. Blood. Strangely, Langdon was standing in it.
Am I bleeding?
Langdon felt no pain, and yet he frantically began searching himself for some injury or possible reaction to an unseen toxin in the air. He checked his nose for a possible bleed, his fingernails, his ears. Baffled as to where the blood had come from, Langdon glanced around, confirming that he was indeed alone on the deserted walkway. Langdon looked down at the puddle again, and this time he noticed a tiny rivulet flowing along the boardwalk and collecting in the low spot at his feet. The red liquid, it seemed, was coming from somewhere up ahead and trickling down an incline in the boardwalk.
Someone is injured up there, Langdon sensed.
He glanced quickly out at Bruder, who was nearing the center of the lagoon. Langdon strode quickly up the boardwalk, following the rivulet. As he advanced toward the dead end, the rivulet became wider, flowing freely.
What in the world?
At this point, it turned into a small stream. He broke into a jog, following the flowing liquid all the way to the wall, where the boardwalk suddenly ended. Dead end. In the murky darkness, he found a large pool, which was glistening red, as if someone had just been slaughtered here. In that instant, as Langdon watched the red liquid dripping off the boardwalk into the cistern, he realized that his original assessment was mistaken. It's not blood. The red lights of the vast space, combined with the red hue of the boardwalk, had created an illusion, giving these clear droplets a reddish-black tint. It's just water. Instead of bringing a sense of relief, the revelation infused him with blunt fear. He stared down at the puddle of water, now seeing splashes on the banister and footprints. Someone climbed out of the water here. Langdon spun to call out to Bruder, but he was too far away, and the music had progressed into a fortissimo of brass and timpani. It was deafening. Langdon suddenly felt a presence behind him.
I'm not alone out here.
In slow motion, Langdon turned toward the wall where the boardwalk dead-ended. 10 feet away, shrouded in dark shadows, he was able to discern a rounded form, like a large stone cloaked in black cloth, dripping in a pool of water. The form was motionless. And then it moved. The form elongated, its featureless head rotating upward from its bowed position. A person huddled in a black burqa, Langdon realized. The traditional Islamic body covering left no skin showing, but as the veiled head turned toward Langdon, two dark eyes materialized, staring out through the narrow slit of the burqa's face covering, locking intently on Langdon. In an instant, he knew. Sienna Brooks exploded from her hiding place. She accelerated to a sprint in a single stride,
plowing into Langdon and driving him to the ground as she raced off down the boardwalk. Chapter 93. Out in the lagoon, Agent Bruder had stopped in his tracks. The halogen beam of his Tovatec penlight had just picked up the sharp glint of metal up ahead on the submerged cistern floor. Barely breathing, Bruder took a delicate step closer, cautious not to create any turbulence in the water. Through the glassy surface, he could now make out a sleek rectangle of titanium bolted to the floor. Zobrist's plaque. The water was so clear, he could almost read tomorrow's date and accompanying text. In this place, on this date, the world was changed forever.
Think again, Bruder mused, his confidence rising. We have several hours to stop this before tomorrow.
Picturing Zobrist's video, Bruder gently inched the flashlight beam to the left of the plaque, searching for the tethered Soljeblon bag. As the beam illuminated the darkened water, Bruder strained his gaze in confusion.
No bag.
He moved the beam farther to the left, to the precise spot where the bag had appeared on the video. Still nothing.
But it was right here.
Bruder's jaw clenched as he took another tentative step closer, sweeping the beam slowly around the entire area.
There was no bag.
Only the plaque. For a brief, hopeful instant, Bruder wondered if perhaps this threat, like so many things today, had been nothing but an illusion.
Was it all a hoax? Did Zobrist just want to scare us?
And then he saw it. To the left of the plaque, barely visible on the lagoon floor, lay a limp tether. The flaccid string looked like a lifeless worm in the water. At the far end of the string was a tiny plastic clasp, from which hung a few tatters of Soljeblon plastic. Bruder stared down at the frayed relic of the transparent bag. It clung to the end of the tether like the tattered knot of a popped party balloon. The truth settled slowly in his gut.
We're too late.
He pictured the submerged bag dissolving and breaking apart, its deadly contents spreading out into the water and bubbling up to the surface of the lagoon. With a tremulous finger, he flicked off his flashlight and stood a moment in the darkness, trying to gather his thoughts. Those thoughts turned quickly to prayer.
God, help us all.
Agent Bruder, repeat! Sinsky shouted into her radio, descending halfway down the stairwell into the cistern, trying to get better reception.
I didn't copy that.
The warm wind rushed past her up the stairs toward the open doorway above. Outside, the SRS team had arrived, and its members were prepping behind the building in an effort to keep their hazmat gear out of sight while they waited to receive Bruder's assessment.
Ruptured bag, Bruder's voice crackled in Sinsky's calm. And released.
What?
Sinsky prayed she was misunderstanding, as she rushed farther down the stairs.
Repeat,
she commanded, nearing the base of the stairwell where the orchestral music grew louder. Bruder's voice was much clearer this time.
And I repeat, the contagion has been dispersed.
Sinsky lurched forward, nearly falling into the cistern's entryway at the base of the stairwell.
How can that be?
The bag has dissolved,
Bruder's voice snapped loudly.
The contagion is in the water.
A cold sweat gripped Dr. Sinsky as she raised her eyes and tried to process the sprawling underground world now spread out before her. Through the reddish haze, she saw a vast expanse of water, from which sprang hundreds of columns. Most of all, however, she saw people. Hundreds of people. Sinsky stared out at the unsuspecting crowd, all of them confined in Zobrist's underground death trap. She reacted on instinct.
Agent Bruder, come up at once. We'll begin evacuating people immediately.
Bruder's reply was instantaneous.
Absolutely not. Seal the doors. Nobody gets out of here.
As director of the World Health Organization, Elizabeth Sinsky was accustomed to having her orders followed without question. For an instant,
She thought she had misunderstood the lead SRS agent's words.
Seal the doors?
Dr. Sinsky, Bruder shouted over the music. Do you read me? Close the goddamn doors!
Bruder repeated the command, but it was unnecessary. Sinsky knew he was correct. In the face of a possible pandemic, containment was the only viable option. Sinsky reflexively reached up and gripped her lapis lazuli amulet. Sacrifice the few to save the many. With a hardening resolve, she raised the radio to her lips.
Confirmed, Agent Bruder. I'll give the order to seal the doors.
Sinsky was about to turn away from the horror of the cistern and give the command to seal the area when she sensed a sudden commotion in the crowd. Not far away, a woman in a black burqa was dashing toward her along a crowded boardwalk, knocking people out of the way as she ran. The veiled woman seemed to be headed directly for Sinsky and the exit.
She's being chased,
Sinsky realized, spotting a man running behind her. Then Sinsky froze.
That's Langdon.
Sinsky's eyes whipped back to the woman in the burqa, who was approaching fast and now shouting something in Turkish to all the people on the boardwalk. Sinsky didn't speak Turkish, but judging from the panicked reaction of the people, the woman's words were the equivalent of shouting fire in a crowded theater. A ripple of panic swept through the crowd, and suddenly it was not only the veiled woman and Langdon who were dashing for the stairs. Everyone was. Sinsky turned her back to the oncoming stampede and began shouting desperately up the stairs to her team.
Lock the doors! Sinsky screamed. Seal the cistern now!
By the time Langdon skidded around the corner into the stairwell, Sinsky was halfway up the stairs, clambering toward the surface, shouting wildly to close the doors. Sienna Brooks was close on her heels, struggling with her heavy, wet burqa as she lumbered up the stairs. Bounding after them, Langdon could feel a tidal wave of terrified concertgoers surging up behind him.
Seal the exit!
Sinsky shouted again. Langdon's long legs carried him three steps at a time, gaining fast on Sienna. Above, he could see the cistern's heavy double doors begin to swing inward.
Too slow.
Sienna overtook Sinsky, grabbing her shoulder and using it as leverage to launch past her, clambering wildly over her toward the exit. Sinsky stumbled forward onto her knees, her beloved amulet hitting the cement stairs and breaking in half. Langdon fought the instinct to stop and help the fallen woman, but instead he hurtled past her, sprinting toward the top landing. Sienna was only a few feet away now, almost within reach, but she had attained the landing and the doors were not closing fast enough. Without breaking stride, Sienna deftly angled her slender body and leaped sideways through the narrow opening. She was halfway through the doors when her burqa snagged on a latch, halting her in her tracks, wedged in the middle of the doorway, mere inches from freedom. As she writhed to escape, Langdon's hand shot out and seized a clump of her burqa. He held fast, pulling back, trying to reel her in, but she wriggled frantically and suddenly Langdon was holding only a wet clump of fabric. The doors slammed onto the fabric, barely missing Langdon's hands. The wadded cloth was now pinched in the doorway, making it impossible for the men outside to push the doors all the way closed. Through the narrow slit, Langdon could see Sienna Brooks sprinting across a busy street, her bald head shining in the streetlights. She was wearing the same sweater and blue jeans she had been wearing all day, and Langdon suddenly felt a fiery, upwelling sense of betrayal. The feeling lasted only an instant. A sudden, crushing weight rammed Langdon hard against the door. The stampede had arrived behind him. The stairwell echoed with shouts of terror and confusion as the sounds of the symphony orchestra deteriorated into a confused cacophony below. Langdon could feel the pressure on his back increasing as the bottleneck thickened. His ribcage began to compress painfully against the door. Then, the doors exploded outward and Langdon was launched into the night like a cork from a bottle of champagne. He stumbled across the sidewalk, nearly falling into the street. Behind him, a stream of humanity was flowing up out of the earth like ants escaping from a poisoned anthill. The SRS agents, hearing the sounds of chaos, now emerged from behind the building. Their appearance in full hazmat gear and respirators immediately amplified the panic. Langdon turned away and peered across the street after Sienna. All he could see was traffic and lights and confusion. Then, for a fleeting instant, down the street to his left, the pale flash of a bald head shone in the night, darting along a crowded sidewalk and disappearing around a corner.
Langdon shot a desperate glance behind him, searching for Sinsky or the police, or an SRS agent who was not wearing a bulky hazmat suit. Nothing. Langdon knew he was on his own. Without hesitation, he sprinted after Sienna. Far below, in the deepest recesses of the cistern, Agent Bruder stood all alone in the waist-deep water. The sounds of pandemonium echoed through the darkness as frenzied tourists and musicians shoved their way toward the exit and disappeared up the stairs. The doors were never sealed, Bruder realized to his horror. Containment has failed.